May it please the court, good afternoon. Patrick Collins on behalf of Ronald Brooks. This is the appeal of the denial of his motion for post-conviction relief. Mr. Brooks was convicted of trafficking in cocaine as well as numerous firearm and other drug charges and is currently serving a 148-year sentence. Much of the evidence that convicted Mr. Brooks came from the testimony of Rose Epps, who herself avoided 20 years of minimum mandatory jail time if convicted by taking a plea to conspiracy second the day before trial in exchange for agreeing to testify for the state. A significant amount of the state's case came from the testimony of Rose Epps. Now, this court has held recently in Smith and in Hoskins that when such testimony from an accomplice is given in a case, the Smith language says when the state's evidence includes the testimony of an accomplice. The Hoskins language says when the testimony of an accomplice is a material issue in a case, that the defendant as a matter of law is entitled to a bland instruction. A bland instruction was not given here, and trial counsel in his affidavit admitted that it was an oversight on his part to fail to request that instruction. This court held again in Smith, but in so holding in Smith, hearkening back to over 40 years of jurisprudence on this issue, that there's no reasonable trial strategy or tactic which would justify the failure to request a special instruction when testimony comes from an accomplice in a case. In Mr. Brooks' case, since the testimony of Ms. Epps was so important to the state's case, it undermined confidence in the outcome of this trial, and as such, Mr. Brooks is entitled to a new trial, the second prong of Strickland also being established.
Well, can we focus on that second prong a little bit?
Yes, Your Honor.
Clearly, she testified against your client, but wasn't there significant other evidence, including fingerprints and other kind of irrefutable evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, and I do believe it's helpful to parse that out a little bit. This was not a case where Mr. Brooks was found with these items on his person, nor where he was found, for example, driving a car and there was a traffic stop and all these things were found in the car. These items were found in a trunk of a car in a very distinctive purse. To Your Honor's point, there was definite evidence that Mr. Brooks touched that car because his fingerprints were on it. There was evidence that about 4 days before the search warrant was executed, Mr. Brooks drove that car because a surveillance officer watched him drive it. The other, let's call it irrefutable evidence or credible evidence, came from a straw purchaser of weapons that were found inside the purse, inside the trunk of the Chevy Lumina. That witness testified that he didn't know Mr. Brooks by name, but he, in essence, traded guns for drugs. Those particular guns were traced and purchased through serial number. However, those straw purchases took place on July 6th, July 23rd, and August 6th. The indictment charges offenses which occurred on August 16th. I think that covers what Your Honor termed as sort of irrefutable evidence.
Well,
it's additional evidence, but I wouldn't consider it corroborative to the important evidence provided by Ms. Epps.
Well, then let's focus on that. How was her evidence so critical to the case?
Well, she establishes the temporal proximity and the possession of both the guns and the drugs. For example, She testified that she and Mr. Brooks were both on a lease together. She ties him to the distinctive purse that most of the items were found in, because she said that about three times a week he would, quote, clear the house out at night by putting the guns and the drugs from the house and then putting them in the bag and leaving the house. She never actually saw him put them in the Lumina, but she saw him leave the house with them. She testified that...
Let me stop you right there, because yes, we already have other evidence of the bag being where the drugs were, where the guns were stashed, right? You had said there was a straw purchaser of weapons and that they were purchased out of this bag, right?
Not out of the bag, Your Honor. They were purchased through a person who could legally purchase guns, in essence, and they were later found in the bag.
Okay.
Mr. Brooks was observed through surveillance carrying the bag into the house. He was never observed carrying the bag out of the house or placing the bag inside the trunk of the Lumina.
All right, but what I'm trying to ferret out here is that although she specifically says that three times a week he put the guns in the bag,
right,
there's other evidence that places those guns in those bag, in that bag, and him connected to them, right?
There's definitely evidence connecting him to the guns in terms of being a recipient through a straw purchaser. As to being in possession of those guns during the commission of a felony on the 16th of August, or as being a person prohibited on the 16th of August as charged in the indictment, that came from Rose Epps. For she testified that the day before the search warrant was executed, she happened to come home early from work and found him apparently with guns and drugs, you know, spread out on the kitchen table, etc. And he told her, according to his testimony, to go upstairs. And when she came back down, everything was gone. So the person who establishes the temporal proximity between the possession of these items and the date charged in the indictment is Rose Epps. She further testified that he had a gun on him at all times. That came from no one else, uncorroborated. The incident that I just mentioned, uncorroborated by anyone else. And by anyone else, I mean no other testimony in the case covered this. She also testified, uncorroborated, that while they were in holding cells in the lockup awaiting to be taken to their various destinations, in Ms. Epps' case it was Baylor Women's Correctional, that he shouted things to her like, stick to the script and make sure you don't say anything and things like that. That statement, admissible against Mr. Brooks, came solely from the testimony of Rose Epps and was not corroborated. So I think the best way to kind of summarize the other evidence versus the Rose Epps evidence is that there was definitely evidence which established prior bad acts. There was evidence that established that he quite likely received these guns in the month leading up to his arrest. But as far as establishing his activities, his habits, his possession of the cocaine and the guns on the day before the search warrant is executed, his habit of taking that purse out somewhere every night or every other night or something, that all came from Rose Epps. And the problem with that is, and what undermines confidence in the outcome of the case, is that the jury was not properly instructed on how to view her testimony. And, you know, this court has established through this line of cases, from Bland to Cabrera to Bordley to Smith to Hoskins, etc., there's kind of two core principles to this sort of evidence. One is that accomplice testimony has to be given special consideration, just like this jury was instructed on how to view expert testimony, how to view testimony of a person who has conviction of a felony, etc.
How should we handle a circumstance where and I think this is one of your points, but where the accomplice testimony may be corroborated on some of the charges, but it's not corroborated on some other charges. Does that require, is it done charge by charge, the analysis, or is it just whether there is some corroboration?
Your Honor, I think that's a good point and very germane to this case, because as Justice Berger was pointing out, there was, for example, evidence that he did, Mr. Brooks did establish possession of three of the four guns charged, for example. I think the best way to say it would be that the trial judge should have the latitude to bifurcate those instructions as to certain charges if he or she sees fit. However, if only one element of one count in the indictment is materially established by accomplice testimony, then that instruction should be given. If the judge feels that the corroboration was particularly strong on a particular count or counts, I could certainly see the case for sectioning off that particular count. But in this case, it seems like, in particular, in the trial court's opinion, the court held, well, there's no prejudice because there were other evidence, but didn't perform the analysis that Your Honor is suggesting. There was other evidence.
I haven't suggested anything. I'm just asking.
Your question suggests it to me would be a better way of saying it. There was some corroborative evidence of some of the charges, but not of other of the charges. For example, there was no corroboration besides from Rose Epps that there were drugs in the distinctive purse that she saw Mr. Brooks carrying. The only evidence that he even carried it from a person other than Rose Epps was from a surveillance officer stationed 175 feet away taking videotape. So, but to Your Honor's point, I think there could be cases, and this may be one of them, where the instruction may be more applicable to some counts than others. But I think what happened here was that the trial court's analysis of the Strickland claim went the other way around, was to say that it shouldn't have been given because there was some evidence of some of the charges.
Well, let's assume we adopt this approach that there has to be an accomplice cautionary instruction when there's no corroboration as to some charges, but there is as to others. The consequence of not giving that, does that mean that there's no prejudice as to some charges, but prejudice as to others, so that the outcome of the appeal should be certain convictions are reversed and remanded for a new trial, or is it an all or nothing situation?
Well, because the instruction pertains to the witness, Your Honor, I think it should be an all-or-nothing situation. The witness has, because the issue of corroboration is covered within the instruction. If the newest pattern instruction is given that was pre-Solomon, pre-Boardley, but goes back to Cabrera, which was a revised pattern instruction, as long as it says caution and suspicion, and then move on to segment two, which is evaluate the corroborating evidence, that's how the jury should view that particular witness. I think to say to a jury, you should view this witness one way with count one and view the witness another way with count two is probably not a correct statement of the law. Besides, it's subsumed within the instruction itself. So as to count one, a jury could say, well, great caution plus no corroboration equals great caution. Great caution plus some corroboration equals something else, perhaps. But that should be the province of the jury. Now, I could see in a case where there's separate witnesses, as there has been, such as Bland or cases like that, where there's separate witnesses being different instructions for different witnesses. But I think the best approach, keep things, in essence, straightforward and simple and an accurate statement of the law would be just to give one instruction as to that witness. I have a little bit of time left, and I would like to mention another claim, if I may, if the court is doesn't have any other questions about the Bland issue, and that is with respect to the jury instructions in this case regarding possession. There were six separate definitions or non-definitions of possession given in this case. I say non-definitions because four of the definitions just referred to previous unnamed definitions of possession. This case happened to feature charges in such a manner that virtually every type of possession that we have in the law was instructed upon. And in Lacates recently, and in other cases, but most recently Lacates, this court has taken note that possession, even in lay terms, but more so in legal terms, is an extremely confusing and ambiguous word. This was a case that cried out for specific instructions as to each form of possession. You had trafficking possession, so in essence drug possession, possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony, which is, let's call it the other sort of possession. Then you had various other possessions, including ammunition, including possession of a deadly weapon by a person prohibited, possession of paraphernalia, etc. What the jury was left with I'm in my rebuttal now, but I'll just wrap up. What the jury was left with was just, in essence, a Byzantine multi-page document where they were supposed to somehow know how to go to which definition of possession. Where trial counsel was ineffective in that situation was failing to establish which definition of possession applied to each case. And since Mr. Brooks has an unqualified right to have the jury instructed correctly on the law, that didn't happen here. And there
was that covered in argument?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Was it covered in argument as to sorting out the definitions that apply?
It was covered in the state's closing argument. To some extent, Your Honor. At trial, is that what you...
Yes,
Your Honor. The state did make a passing mention to the dominion and control style of possession versus the actual proximity possession of firearm during commission of a felony. Defense counsel didn't really mention it and focused closing argument much more so on the credibility of Rose Epps.
Do you want to save the rest of your time?
I will. Thank you, Your Honor.
Police the court, Timothy Donovan on behalf of the state, addressing the Bland instruction issue. My colleague, Mr. Collins, I think has hit on most of the corroboration. However, I would like to hit last on the possession of this very distinctive black and white, referred to as the cow print bag, and in which, of course, everything was found. The drugs were found, the guns were found. I think a little bit of ammunition was found in the house, and some more ammunition, I think, was found in a bag outside the front door. But the main event was the drugs and the guns found in the cow print bag, which were located in the trunk of the Lumina. And the surveilling officer, now admittedly from roughly, I think he said, 60 yards away, did observe, I believe twice, and videotaped once, Mr. Brooks in possession, walking from the car to the house, carrying a black and white bag, approximately the size of the cow print bag that was ultimately located. So there was certainly evidence other than Rose Epps' testimony connecting him with that bag, and then added to that three of the four guns that were found in the same bag with the drugs could be traced directly from the seller to Mr. Brooks. There was ample evidence that this bag belonged to, was Mr. Brooks' drug and gun bag. Without Ms. Epps' testimony, I'm not saying Ms. Epps' testimony was completely superfluous, by no means. I mean, she testified to things that the surveilling officer couldn't see. That is what went on inside the house. That at night, Mr. Brooks would gather together his drugs and weapons, put them in the bag, and take them out and hide them outside somewhere, whether in the Lumina or the Lexus or something else, we don't know. So, her testimony was important, and she certainly was, if not an active accomplice here, she was an enabler, certainly. She allowed Mr. Brooks to use the house that she had rented. She allowed one of the cars to be registered in her name, even though Mr. Brooks had bought the car, again, to shift suspicion. With Illumina, she had purchased, but never changed the registration to her name. But there's testimony where Mr. Brooks was seen driving that car. Unlike the case that I think is probably procedurally close to this case, the Smith case, which was again a Rule 61 case, in that case, the testimony of the accomplice, who was the actual principal, he was the shooter in that case, Mr. DeShields. Mr. Smith's guilt of everything depended on Mr. DeShields' testimony that there was a conspiracy to rob the victim prior to Mr. DeShields shooting and killing him. Mr. Smith, without that testimony, well, he was present, that's all that could be established, but whether he had anything to do with anything, whether he was guilty of anything, depended solely on Mr. DeShields' testimony that there was a conspiracy to rob, and therefore Mr. Smith was guilty of felony murder.
If we back out of the case, Rose Epps' statements, which are uncorroborated, are there any particular charges for which there is then insufficient evidence?
I find it very difficult in this case to parse out any charges. I mean, again, the main event, all the charges, there were some minor charges, but I think there's some corroboration, or there's some evidence outside of Ms. Epps' testimony for everything. Certainly all the weapons offenses, and there was 12 of them, I believe, including the ammunition, deal with the guns found in the bag, and of course the trafficking possession with intent to deliver, that was the drugs found in the bag. And there was certainly evidence to connect, strongly connect Mr. Brooks to that bag without Ms. Epps' testimony at all. Again, I don't mean to say her testimony was not important. It was significant. And it would have been a much tougher case to prove without it. But it was not, unlike the case in Smith, it was not, without that testimony, we would have no case at all. We were ready to go forward without her testimony. Again, it would have been a tough case, but it would have been provable. I'm saying in Smith, the court did say that each case is, in fact, that in meeting the prejudice prong of Strickland, let me say here, trial counsel said, look, it was an oversight. So I just didn't think about it. So it was not a strategic decision. So the first prong of Strickland, the deference due to trial counsel's strategic decision-making is not an issue here. And the trial judge here went directly to the second prong and said, well, look, under the facts of this case, relying on Smith. Smith says, well, you have to look at these cases, one case at a time and see how prejudicial the lack of this instruction was. And the trial judge ruled that there was really no reasonable probability that had I given it a bland type instruction, whether it was an actual bland language instruction or a bland type instruction, pattern jury instruction, that the results of the trial would have been different. That there was such ample proof of Mr. Brooks' connection with that cow print bag outside of Ms. Epps' corroborating testimony. I may just, the court has no further questions on that. Just briefly address the possession instructions. And my colleague does not say the instructions were not a correct statement of the law. They were. And I think if one looks at the positioning of the instruction, rather than repeat the same possession instruction for each of the, I think I said 12 of these, possession of a firearm, possession by a person prohibited, possession of ammunition, by a person prohibited again, the judge would give one instruction first and then all the counts that deal with that instruction. When he got to the during the commission of a felony, which of course has the additional element of immediate accessibility during, in this case, a continuing felony of trafficking, the judge again added to the general possession instruction that particular element and instructed the jury as to that. The only disagreement I have is that then the judge went back to the person prohibited, which of course to instruct on that charge, but rather than refer back to the general possession, which of course is for person prohibited, instructed the jury on the during the commission of a felony. Now, in this case, it doesn't make any difference since the same guns, which were right next to the trafficking weight of drugs, formed the basis for both charges. But and the any misinstruction here worked to the defendant's benefit since it added an extra element to person prohibited. But no, I think the positioning of the various in possession charges in the instructions that were given to the jury would take care of any kind of confusion.
Was there any indication of jury confusion, questions from the jury?
None whatsoever, Your Honor. No. Right. The court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm struck by the appellee's comments. A candid admission that Rose Epps' testimony was important to the state's case, and that is reflected in the record. It was the first witness mentioned by the prosecutor in the opening statement. Prosecutor spent much of his closing statement trying to rehabilitate her credibility in the face of certain things in cross-examination. And it was her testimony that established all the close-in-time possession of these items. Just about all the other evidence, which the trial court found corroborative, but I will call additional evidence, was much more remote in time and didn't establish elements of the offense on that date. I think what what's needed is just a bright line rule that says every time an accomplice testifies in a case, the jury gets an instruction which tells them to treat this witness with special consideration. And that special consideration can be ameliorated in the face of corroborative evidence. There is, for example, Bland and Smith would be another good example where there was precious little corroborative evidence. This may be a case that's not at that end of the continuum, but the corroborative evidence doesn't establish beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of the charges in the case. So this was, may I just conclude?
Sure.
This was a case that, very serious case with very serious charges. The jury did not get an accurate statement of the law as to how to consider this witness and any corroborating evidence. And as such, there can't be confidence in the outcome, and he should be granted a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under consideration and recess.
Ms. Bryce?